Anyway, we're excited to make another stab at this topic of space tonight. And so I'm gonna frame it a couple different ways. I'm starting off just with a little bit of a reminder of our earlier lessons. So we have the definition of mercy that we've been working with, our working definition here, and then the four key relationships house. Just it's kind of like those two topics, the heart topic and then our intro topic, I think it's just a really important ones to kind of bring to bear on this particular lesson, remembering that mutual brokenness in the four key relationship is what keeps us in a kind of a humble posture as it relate to people who are under materially poor or under-resourced. And then just this great definition of mercy that Randy Neighbors uses. It's helpful. So we're thinking about why do we want to be in these spaces? Because we have this powerful tool, mercy, that really frees people, that equips them, and that also helps us do a good job of walking with people who are in a situation that's very broken. So just keeping this in mind. These are things we've talked about in the past. And if you weren't here in the past, our lessons from the past are on the back on those chairs, so you can always grab whatever week you've missed. So, but I want to frame today's topic with kind of just a reminder of what we were kind of getting at last week. So I'll ask a question. Yeah, this is not a did you get the right answer kind of question, but just making sure we're on the same page. So today we're going to keep talking about ways to place value on people and spaces that are under-resourced and marked by struggle, poverty, neglect. So let's remember together from our last session, why is space, physical space, a vital component of mercy ministry? This is just jogging the memory from last week. People who weren't here can kind of pick up to speed, and then we can jump off. So why is physical space? I'm going to keep some notes while you talk, so we can have kind of a running list here. And then you don't have to feel shy. You can just call out your thoughts.
Yes,
I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but something similar to the physical space that you see is not really the whole picture of what really is.
Cool. Yeah, that was definitely something we talked about last week.
Either the space around or the people within.
Yeah. So there is much more. And meets the eye. Is that kind of what you're saying, Miss Linda? There's much more to a place of poverty than meets the eye. Much more to it. Many more assets. Many more people there than it's oftentimes described by or identified by. It's not just full of criminals. It's not just full of people who can't help themselves. Good. Another thing that sort of is, why is physical space an important thing to remember or keep in mind as we go about practicing the art of mercy ministry?
The idea of observing the people that may be in that physical space.
We got to get to them somehow. Yeah. Yep. Context. Great. All right, other thoughts. Why is it so vital?
I think our perception of how things are, our assumptions, that's why we don't even...
Come on. I love that. Did you guys hear? Our perspectives or our assumptions, it could challenge those when we move into these spaces and see it for what it is, or it could help us move there. Again, challenges. Great. One final thought. Why is the physical spaces that make up our world important as we think about mercy ministry?
It's their comfort zone.
Very helpful. Engaging with people on their turf, so to speak, is very important. Yeah, I love it. Their turf.
Something that was brought to my attention yesterday is that since it is maybe their comfort zone, mm-hmm. we may be feel threatening. We may be a threat to that comfort if we're not
Sure.
Demeanor.
Yeah.
That has a,
yeah.
Has
a no, but I think it's important. No, it really, really is. I mean, going in there like you own the place or can you can be
you
a threat.
You need to be sensitive to yeah. that.
Yep, 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 yep. Got to learn the ropes. Good. Helps us remain a humble, have a humble posture when you realize that when you can sort of surrender that idea of and walk in with that, this isn't my place. I don't know how to operate here. Okay, this is great. So, just getting us back up to speed, the ropes. So, our goal tonight, we're really excited about tonight's. Based on just some feedback from last week, we thought, you know, this is a good space to kind of pause and create an environment in the class that's more, that's got some more discussion, question and answer kind of component to it. And we thought it's very important that we continue to stress our particular story of engaging with space, right? Moving into West Jackson is just one clear story. And it's not the only way to do this. In fact, can't have everyone move to West Jackson, right? We can't, and we would love some more people to move there, right? But it's not the way to do it necessarily. But there's other people whose other stories of engaging with Mercy Ministry in a way that is helpful. So we brought along two of our friends, four of our friends, but two couples who work together. And we're going to have them kind of be the sort of centerpiece of tonight's conversation about space, telling their stories, talking about what sort of drew them to the work of ministry, what keeps them in it, struggles, pitfalls that they've encountered. Because I think it's helpful to get a broadened view of our perspectives. Now, again, and we're just three white couples. So it's again, this is still very, very one-sided. But I think it's helpful to say, how can I kind of relate to some of the ways that you guys are speaking here? So that's part of it. We'll have a more open question and answer section two, and then we'll kind of wrap it up. And I have a lot of homework for you guys this week. Actually, a lot of the things like we'll talk about will kind of fuel the sort of things to take away from tonight. We'll make sure there's time this time to explain and kind of list out what those are. We have not been able to do that the last couple of weeks, which is good. It means the conversation was roaring, but we don't want to miss that point. Katera, you have a thought?
And then as they're talking, if you have any questions, just for the sake of, it may be that throughout the conversation, a question gets answered. If you will write it down, and then at the end of the time, we'll have
yeah.
kind of an open Q&A. So, but
right.
it also helps you remember your questions too. So
totally.
Make sure you write them down.
There's space on your handouts for that. So before we get to the panel, this is just the kind of set up the panel. This is kind of what I've kind of written up. I think I like it. So I like what we wrote down here. Without sharing space, it's difficult to pursue authentic, heart-transforming relationships through rightly applied hospitality. One of our lessons from before, for giving and receiving. Although we have an idea about the need, right, based on this, for close proximity and forging healthy relationships across class and culture divides, it's not always so simple to apply. I think this is a sort of main takeaway from last week is that this is not, how do you start doing this? What are some real tangibles? So owning that, it's not easy to apply. There's a lot of obstacles to actually being able to engage in this work consistently, which is what it requires. Relationships require consistent interaction. And so this is going to help us kind of jump over. So how do we jump over the roadblocks that are in my life, your life? And I don't know the specific ones in your life. But we're going to kind of, so as we do the panel talks, I think it'll help. But I have kind of like, I think here's what we need in order to do that. So I think before we get it to the what should I do, I think we need a few things. And I've written these down in your notes. So there's four things I think we need. And I think the first one is what we're trying to accomplish tonight with this panel. I think we need stories and examples and testimonies from people we know. So now you're going to meet these people, so you're going to know them. You know us. And we need more people that we know who are doing this work that can help us kind of contextualize for us, how does a person who kind of occupies a middle-class, upper-middle-class life, how do I do this, and what do I have to offer? So we need more people who are doing the work. We need to hear their stories. Number two, we have to have our assumptions challenged by timely information about the realities of poverty so our compassion and faith can grow, outlasting our apprehension. I think combined with stories, combined with good information, timely information about the realities of poverty can help us to sort of switch from reasonable apprehension based on your station life to faith-filled engagement So I think that helps. Number three, I think we need opportunities to put theory to test and gain experiences. Got to have that. We need time. I guess I have four things here, but I forgot to. It's probably five on your notes, but it ended up on four on mine. But yeah, so we need those opportunities, volunteering, driving around the neighborhood, those kind of things. Five, we need time to keep assessing the condition of our hearts. That was unit one of this whole thing was, where is my heart at in this thing? Do I have a God complex? Am I trying to save everything? We got to keep assessing that in every engagement. It's important. And finally, like this space here, we need safe spaces to process all of that. So I do think as we do this, that's something that's difficult to do alone. And I always caution people against doing it alone. Some people that I've known who've tried this get burned out real fast because you get either taken advantage of one time, the family that you really tried to help ends up going back out and doing the same thing, or you realize you're enabling. I mean, it's so easy to burn out. So there's got to be a safe place to process this. And this is what we had with our friends Will and Anna and Robert and Jessica. We've had these safe places to sort of process how to do this well, working on it together. So we're going to lean into those ideas today as we think about space. And we're starting with number one, which is what who we have as our panel. So why don't you guys welcome Will and Anna and Robert and Jessica up to these four tables here. All right, so I'm going to try to serve as the moderator of this conversation. And then they're trying to record this, so we'll just pass the mic as we answer.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
So I'm just going to have them go ahead and introduce themselves to you, talk about where they live, who they are, who's in their family, just simple. Simple, like, little baseball card.
Baseball card. All right. I'm Robert Aiken. It's my wife, Jessica, right here. We have two boys, Wilkes and Anderson, and we live in the Broadmoor neighborhood, which is North Side and North State. So.
And I'm Jessica, his wife. My name is Anna McNeese, and this is my husband, Will McNeese, and we have four children. 864 and little tiny, and we live in Fondren.
Will, anything to add to that?
I'm Will. I'm a therapist in the area and grew up not far from here, so that's who I am.
For these next ones, whoever wants to answer, you just pop that hand up. All right, so our class is about mercy ministry. So this is something that we're interested in knowing what motivated y'all in your various instances to get involved with people on the margins, and what was the thing that stirred your compassion? We all have a story of kind of entry point here. Let you think for a second.
I'll answer that.
Hey, Levi, could you ask them what it is they do?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Okay, Will told you he's a therapist. What do you do, Robert?
I work at the Redeemer School. I do a little bit of everything, student activities, logistics, athletics, just a little bit of everything. And I'll let her answer for herself.
Thank you. I am a kindergarten teacher at Mission First Early Learning Center. And I homeschool my kiddos.
So I am a therapist by trade, and then in addition to that, I am on the actually we all are on the Hope Exchange leadership team, and Levi and Robert and I and Kateri are all faith and finance facilitators. So that's a curriculum put out by the Chalmers Center. That's one of the curriculums we offer to people in the community. And so Levi and I work at Sunnybrook Children's Home up in Ridgeland, about once a week we go up there. He goes up more often, but I help teach class to they no longer have kids who live there in the same way they used to. It's a transition program, so it's kids in the foster system who are about to age out, but it's largely generationally impoverished kids, teenagers, and they're either late high school or into college, and so we're going through faith and finance with them. So I've been doing that for, how long have we been doing at Sunnybrook? Since September of last year. So almost a year. So that's part of what I do. Robert, were you about to?
Yeah, I was going to take a stab at it. When we thought about getting into ministry, we didn't think people in the margins. We went to seminary and went after the MDiv for a little while, and we were thinking campus ministry, RUF. We were both RUF interns. We loved college students. That's where we wanted to go, and that didn't work out. And we just started, got the doors that God was opening for ministry just happened to be people on the margins. And we just started listening and started hearing their stories, hearing their experiences, what it's like to live as a minority or somebody on the margins, somebody who's struggling with finances, and just hear what life was like for them. And God just continued to develop a heart for that people group. And her being a teacher at Mission First, me being at the Redeemer School, that heart has just continued to grow. And we've had to continue to learn what that looks like in our setting, in our neighborhood. But we never set out to do ministry with people on the margins, and God's just continued to open door after door, opportunities to serve with Hope Exchange and facilitate with Hope Exchange, and just different areas of life that we're willing, we're ready, and it's just, these are the doors that He's opening.
Awesome. So, you know, about that topic, what motivated you to get involved with people on the margins?
I'll say too, like, I grew up in the church in the PCA, and my interaction with people who were different than me was very limited, and it was always like serving oriented, like going on a missions trip, and that was my exposure, or delivering food baskets on Thanksgiving. It was very limited, and it was always like, I'm helping you. It wasn't a interaction where I was like living life with, or getting to know, having dinner with, you know, those kind of things. It was very much like, I'm living this life, you're living this life, let me come and help you for a week. And then as I grew into like college and post-college, that, I still had that. Like in college, I would, you know, do things, but I think we kind of grew into this space of, we started going to church with people and living life with people who were from all walks of life. And I know that that's not possible everywhere, but we had like this unique opportunity to go to church with people who, I mean, there were people who came into our church off the street because of where our church was located at the time. And it was in a different state. But I think that really, like that safe space of like this church where we felt safe, was, and then we were interacting, and then we became friends with and started doing Bible study with. And that interaction of like really becoming friends with people and doing life with people was kind of, for me, the shift of like, it's not really me living my life and there are different people and I know about different people and they have different things going on. It became like, that's my friend and that's what they're going through, and not like what, you know, TV told me these people were like, or this book told me what these people were like. It was like, that's my friend. Or that's my student. That's the mom of my student. That's the shift. And then once I was kind of in, it was like, well, this just makes so much sense, you know? And I feel like the Lord really brought those opportunities to kind of begin to soften my heart and change my preconceived notions that I had about that, I guess. So that's kind of where that shift for me happened.
Yeah, so I had, like, God was working in my life in kind of two fronts, I think, or two areas that kind of converged around this. One was just professionally, being a therapist. I went to RTS and got great training, and we did touch on, you know, working with people who come from material poverty and some of the differences that it's kind of different from the typical, like, you know, when you think of therapy, it's, you know, white person, middle class, kind of talking about how they feel unfulfilled in life, or, you know, whatever, and you know, they're anxious. working with people who, my experience was working with people who came from material poverty, it was just so much more complex. Everything about what we were, what they were going through, life stressors, their family life, the relational problems, the emotional problems, it just felt more complex because there was, it felt like there was so much of it happening. And so that for me was a little disorienting as professionally trying to figure out how do we do this? How do we start? And so that kind of got me interested in, I remember just feeling like I didn't read the right book in therapy in school for doing this work. And I don't have my practice is not largely towards people who are from generational poverty at all. But I have them in my practice. So that was always there I was interested in I'm missing something and I don't like that feeling of missing something. As well as, you know, kind of similar to what you were saying, Jessica, I came from PCA, you know, middle class, white, conservative kind of background. And that's kind of both the theological attitude and the political attitude and the cultural attitude I had, you know, was very much emphasizing personal responsibility. And that kind of had my framework on how I understood what the problems of poor people was like that. I kind of had it in a box. And as I started interacting with people at my church and people who just began developing relationships with my wife, it started really becoming apparent that it's clashing. So this is not surviving first contact. Something is needing to change. Something's needing to be adjusted because the situation is more complex. I'm missing something. And so that I don't like that feeling of not knowing what's going on and feeling like I'm missing something and I don't know how to be in this space. So I was drawn to what I heard about work life when Levi and Kateri would talk about just when they were just doing work life, which is one of the curriculums at our church. I was like, that seems to be circling the right targets and holding the more I learned about it, the more I was seeing the balance of emphasizing broken people, broken systems, the need for personal responsibility, but also the need for the, you know, we got to wake up on those kind of, for me, it was I'm seeing myself as not broken in this, and I'm not seeing the ways that that the systems are broken and that, you know, so I didn't really know how to, I don't know. It just brought me closer, and I don't by any means feel like I have all this reconciled, but I really have enjoyed and been blessed by this experience of continuing to go deeper and learn more.
Okay, so kind of piggybacking off that, and Anna, just shout to us when you want to pipe in. Your perspective is huge. Okay, so here's a question that's come up, or that a topic we've been wrestling with in class is this idea of what hospitality looks like. We've talked about hospitality as this idea for us, and merciful hospitality is giving and receiving. So you have something to give, but you also are in a position relationally to receive. So I want you to describe a situation where you've received hospitality from someone that you've been in a relationship with, who could be categorized as materially poor. Received hospitality from.
Well, I think I'll share one from me that's been fun. So I have a friend named Chef who I got to know when I was working at We Will Go. And he is, he's like a grandpa in my kids' life. He bought them, my oldest son, a bike. And so it's one of those things where I was like, I don't know how to receive this from him. This is like, he lives on a fixed income, Social Security check, or SSI check. And I was like, man, this is really a challenging thing. But he didn't have any grandkids. And so he wanted to be able to, you know, buy ASAP a bike. And it was just tough to receive, but it was one of those things that was important to say yes to that bit of hospitality. So just a frame of reference for what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Thoughts, hospitality you've received?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think of our neighbors, Miss Mary and Arthur, even Miss Edna and all of her family that would hang out on their front porch. Whether our kids were riding their bike down the street, they had their eye on them, looking out for them. And a number of times, Arthur would come and he would just clean out our ditch that had been clogged with leaves. To kind of help water from overflowing our ditch. And they would just randomly bring food over and just show love to us and love bringing gifts to the kids, just welcoming us into their home. And yeah, it's been an awesome experience just with the two people that live across the street from us. So, you have anything?
So we'll have a hand raised. Yeah.
Two examples. I had a coworker. This was a couple years back. That was just really, really kind to me. Just always would spend time and talk with me and just carry on conversations. But he would also be really okay, like sitting in silence. And he ended up coming to our wedding, and he bought brought a wedding gift that was really meaningful. It was just like, that was, I don't even feel like I knew you very well. And that just stuck out to me. That was like, that was cool. Another time was just, I've had numerous interactions with clients as well as other just people in Hope Exchange and stuff, where I just felt like I kind of put my foot in my mouth on a couple of occasions, and I was received with lots of grace. And that was, I don't know if that's exactly the same as hospitality, but it felt like that, like, so.
I got a received with grace story if y'all want to feel awkward for a second. So, because it very much felt like hospitality, like in the, oh, mercy. So I went on a missions trip, and we went to go build a home for a woman who had lost her husband in a fishing accident. She had three kids, and so the kids were there, and we're all building, and I thought I'd try out my Spanish. And I ended up not knowingly telling her that our group was going to eat fish at her house for lunch. And she was like, "You are?" And she was excited about it. And I was like, I didn't know what I was saying, but I was saying that we were planning to eat fish back where we were staying. Is that I was just trying to like make some conversation. She's like, "Okay, great." So we work all morning, and then it's time to leave. And she has sent a friend to go get fish for our group. And I was like, what have I done? And I have what I wish I had done, which was like, "Okay, we're eating fish." But what ended up was like, "No, I have to leave because I feel awkward and this is not the plan." And and so we left, and I was just like, I mean, ever since then, I will think about it and just be like, I just feel so ashamed for that. So I had a friend who helped, you know, like translate like my apology, and she was so kind, because I can't imagine that she felt humiliated by the whole experience of having someone come build a house for her who she didn't know, and by like misunderstanding of the whole thing. And so her grace to me and her continued kindness to me in that was big. Felt it huge.
Okay, so here's kind of a broad question to kind of give you a lot of room to wiggle with here. So what would you say have been some lessons that you've learned, you can kind of condense it down to, so far in prioritizing this work?
I think one thing that I learned and I have to continue to remind myself is that even though people are poor, maybe materially or financially, doesn't mean that they're not rich in other areas. I think when I first kind of began this shift that I was talking about earlier, I lived in Ethiopia after I graduated college, and I lived there for a while, and I was dumbfounded by how joyful the people were there. and they had zero, and they would show hospitality with nothing. Like, I would come in, they lived in nothing, they had nothing, and yet they would take the very little that they had and give it away and give it to us. And that blew my mind. But I was in a different country and it was a different culture. So I was like, okay, like, that's wonderful. And it made an impact, but does that translate to America? Right. So I think after I came back and the more exposure that I've had to different people, in different places, we worked on, a Native American, reservation for a little while. In that, demographic and, other demographics that we've worked with. What's shocking to me is I think growing up, you assume poor people are also unhappy because of course you would be unhappy if you're poor. Like, that was like my understanding. Like, if you don't have things and you need things, like, it makes sense to be, you know, depressed or distraught. And not that people aren't, but they also, there are a lot of people who may be materially poor that have the most faith that I've ever seen in Jesus, or are the biggest prayer warriors and have prayed for me in a way that none of my other Christian friends have, or the most generous, the most trusting and relying on Jesus. So all of those things, I think, really humbled me to realize that they, like, people who are poor, even though they may not be able to monetarily offer as much, have, like, so much more to offer in other ways. And I'm sure, like, you were talking about, like, with hospitality, like, being able to give and receive. That's been a big lesson, 'cause it's hard to receive materially from people who are materially poor. But I think it's really good. Like, I feel like that really humbled me to know, like, I'm really not better than anyone, even though that's kind of the posture that I grew up feeling. Like, I'm better. I wouldn't ever say that out loud. I'm better than you, or I'm better, you know. But I would have these feelings of, like, well, I must have made better decisions. I must have really worked hard. I must have, you know, these things inside that I operated out of, even if I wouldn't say that out loud, kind of, like, came crashing down. Like, I'm really not, you know, like, you know, I didn't choose what family I was born into. I didn't choose what place I was born into. And neither did they. And sure, like, personal responsibility and you can make choices, but also, like, some of that just kind of went, you know, some of those assumptions really went out the window for me. And I saw, like, wow, I don't rely on Jesus for my basic needs. And I am very quick to judge, and I'm very quick to keep what I do have and not share. Things like that, that I noticed that they were much better at than I was. So I feel like I still have to remind myself. It's not like I learned that lesson and check, doing great on that all the time. God still is working on that with me. But that was a huge lesson that I just have to remind myself of a lot.
I think I would echo that. You said it well. Arrogance is really, really hard to get around. It's just hard to get away from. That's been painful to see, and humiliating to admit that there is, yeah, this attitude within me that, you know, that God's goal is to get their lives to be more like mine, you know, and it's like, ooh, I don't think that's true. But parts of me do, you know, parts of me just kind of assume that, and, to see that, you know, my job is that the interactions I'm having with the people in my community are me pouring out resources to them. Like, goodness, you know, like, that's what a faulty way of seeing humans and relationships. So, yeah.
I think kind of on similar lines is what y'all have been saying, is that stuff is not our problem. Mm. Our problem is not stuff, how much stuff we have, how little. I guess it is a problem when you have so much stuff. But it's not like, well, there's a panic thing that is within me, like, those people don't have the stuff they need. Like, oh no, we gotta give them stuff. Like, it really isn't, and it's really not, I'd almost say, like, in the United States, a lot. Like, there is so much stuff to be had that when I'm like, oh, I'm going to give you my stuff and feel good about it, it's like, oh, anybody, you can kind of get stuff if you need it, you know? You can probably go get a sheet somewhere. You can probably go get a something somewhere. And that when, I guess I'm trying to think, When I panic, because I go to panic of, oh no, like there's, oh no, the need is so great, and oh, what do we do? That I'm maybe panicking about the wrong thing, that there's a place to check in my heart, like what do I think is wrong in the world? And I don't think Jesus came. I'm sure he had a lot less stuff than I do. And I don't think he came to get more and to help us all have more. So there's something in there with working with the material poverty that, like, yes, we are physical beings that need to take care of our bodies and to have what we need to take care of our bodies and our families. But that we're... When we're working with, like, helping people with material poverty, we can use that as, like, as a kind of jumping off point of, like, of lack of something. But there's something more there that we have a commonality of a need for our Savior and our desperate need for salvation and connection. And I don't want this stuff to get in the way of it all.
That's a good way to summarize your point. I don't want this stuff to get in the way of the relationship.
I'll try to be brief. I've learned that it's hard. Mercy ministry is hard. Whether you're overcoming fatigue, trying to overcome stereotypes. Just losing sight of the fact that God is at work in these individuals, whether I'm there or not. That's one thing I have to remember about Broadmoor specifically, is God was present in Broadmoor long before we thought about moving in. And he will continue to be present in Broadmoor long after we move out, whenever that is. But it's just, it's hard. It's taxing. And at the same time, it's so rewarding to just not come with an arrogance, not come with, I have something to give you, but to be able to sit with people who are struggling and sit with people on the margins and hear their stories, hear their hope in the midst of those sufferings that look different than my own. It's just encouraging, and to constantly remind myself that God is at work, and we can, yes, we need to pursue that relationship, but also be making ourselves aware of learning more about what they're going through, whether it's what does it look like to be on a fixed income? What does it look like to have a parent in jail, having, like, being a single parent? Like, what does that look like? How does that, like, how is that affecting not just the parent, but generations trickling down? And yeah, just trying to take it all in and not trying to do it on our own strength, but because that leads to burnout. You mentioned burnout in a heart. Yeah, it leads to burnout quickly. And yeah, it's hard, but it's worth it.
Well said. Thank you guys for sharing those lessons.
Can I ask one more question before we do our question?
Yeah, so this is the last question before Q&A, so get your questions ready.
I just feel like it's an important kind of thing we talked about last time, and that's like our city has some pretty specific dividing lines, and I think a lot of those dividing lines are based off of fears that we have about people, and I would specifically frame it as like fears about our property being safe, our vehicles being safe, our own persons being safe. And those seem like, if you're at any way in tune with the culture around you, you're born with those if you're in your context. Or if you move into Jackson, you're told that those are the things that you should be afraid of. I'm just curious about any fears that you have had in the past, maybe still struggle with now, and how those ideas may be shifted just for you personally. And what do you still struggle with now? I was wondering if you guys could speak to that.
I struggle a lot with the stereotype that I fit of a white male in America representing the most privileged demographic in America, and presenting myself in places where minorities or the marginalized exist, and just hoping for an opportunity to get to know them and allow my heart to come out and not being judged right off the bat. I still struggle with that. That was a big fear coming in, and just hoping for a chance to get to know people. And I know that can be written off pretty quickly. Just opportunity to care and love for the people that God brings across our path.
I would say as a mom, I've got two little boys, and we moved in to Jackson when my oldest was one. And we heard a lot of like, oh, you don't want to move there. You should really look at Madison, or you should look, you know, like don't move into Jackson was kind of the vibe that we got coming in. I'm not from here, from a different state. So like to me, I was like, I don't have any sort of like context for where I'm coming in. He's from Hazelhurst. So he has more knowledge and more backstory to Mississippi than I do. So to me, I was like, nowhere safe. You know, like that was my attitude. Well, nowhere safe. a little bit naively, like just kind of like, I'll be fine. Nowhere safe. You know, I'll pray for protection wherever I live. You know, just kind of these like, I wasn't too worried coming in just because I'm kind of like that. Like, I'm kind of like, if people tell me not to do something, I'm like, maybe I should do it. And why should I do it? Like, I feel like I should go against the flow. So I was, you know, I'm a little bit of a different personality. But when we were looking at Broadmoor, there were certain things that we definitely knew we had to give up, like certain comforts that we had to give up, and certain things that we definitely needed to be aware of. So one thing I was told when I was looking at is just kind of like it's a street by street basis. And I would say that about a lot of places in Jackson. Like you can live in a really great part of town, but if you live, you know, on this street, then maybe it's not as safe as two streets over, you know. So we were kind of told like, you know, just kind of look and see, you know, you can feel safe or you might not feel safe. So we moved in and pretty immediately felt pretty safe. We were around a lot of older people who had lived there for like 40 years. But then there were several times where there were rental houses and you didn't know who was going to live in that house or live next door. And so we started like kind of seeing some things or experiencing some things that were harder and made me more fearful. And there was one point where we kind of felt like I was like, I can't, like my kids just can't go like ride their bikes around the neighborhood. My kids can't, we can't really go on a walk and feel very safe. Not because of the people sometimes, but because of like dogs or potholes or, you know, like other things besides the people. But there are things that we kind of had to be like, even though I may be not afraid of my physical neighbor, I am in a section of town where things happen. We hear gunshots a fair amount. And we have to gauge, like, was that close or no? You know, like, is that something to be concerned about or no? Things that I might not have to worry about somewhere else. And so there are times where my kids' physical safety comes through my mind. I feel like I need to be out there. We were playing in the backyard for a while when things didn't feel as safe. Now we're more in the front yard because we feel, you know, just these decisions that we have to make personally for our kids. Like, is this safe? Is this not? But at the end of the day, I feel like we feel called to what we're doing, and God's going to meet us where we're at. So even though there are some times where I just really wish I could live in a neighborhood where my kids could ride on sidewalks, we're giving that piece of childhood up that I wish we could have, but we're also giving them an experience of like growing up around people who look different than them and growing up in a different type of neighborhood, and being able to go to school with some of the kids that they're around, you know, things like that. But safety is definitely something that's become more, but I personally haven't felt very unsafe. But I think anytime you go into something new, there is a fear, whether it's for your personal safety, your emotional safety, your mental, you know, just there's fear involved. And I'm a very anxious person generally. And so it's a very real thing. And I think it's okay to feel it. But I also have to remind myself that, like, God, you know, meets us where we are, and he's going to protect us. And we have to be wise about where we are. We have to be, you know, wise and, you know, not just, like, leave things out for people to take, you know, but and lock your doors if you need to. But also not just live in a constant state of, like, you know, anxiety and fear. Because I feel like I could do that anywhere if I let myself and I didn't trust in Jesus. So
we're talking about fear and being like,
She said restate the question.
Can you restate the question?
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah, sorry. I went off on a tangent.
Just again, and it's if it's something that comes to mind too, but like, yeah, in our context, I think we've been taught to fear others. I mean, that's just kind of,
yeah.
And specifically in certain neighborhoods and not in certain neighborhoods. And so just how maybe that has played into, yeah, how have those fears been real for you and how has God been with you from that?
Yeah.
I think maybe it's a better way to answer it.
Yeah, I think, yeah, fear is for sure real for me, just like it is for all y'all. And I think wherever I would live, I would be afraid of something. And yeah, yeah, it is, and it's something I think we're so weak as humans. I mean, we gotta get sleep every single night. We all have to use the bathroom, no matter how powerful we are. We're gonna be, you know, we have to eat. So we are just such needy creatures that, yeah, my fear keeps me going back to the Lord. And I remember talking to you one time because I had a friend who was trying to find a place to move to, and having a really hard time finding a place, and I was asking her about it, and she's like, "Hey, I think I want to move to, I'm looking at this place that's down by the train tracks there, kind of off of West Street." And I was just like, "No, I don't know what to do. Like, what if you move down there? Can I visit you?" Well, I was talking to Kateri, and she's like, "She's your friend. You have to visit her if she moves there." And I was like, "Ah, that's scary. Like, I don't know. So, and I'm.
She looks so concerned.
She's like, I know. She's like, well, Mama. So, I mean, it's, I don't know what to say other than, yeah, that's a struggle. And the world can be scary, and there's people who hurt people. And there's a lot of people who really don't. And most of them don't. No, most people don't want to hurt anybody.
Yeah, and so my experience has been the more I'm around the culture that I have fear of, which growing up that was, I grew up in a very, like, I went to Brandon, so that's one of the diversity of Brandon reflects the diversity of the state, you know, 60-40. So it was a pretty diverse school as far as black and white goes. And so I kind of always, it was not odd for me to be in spaces around African Americans, but I also had also a fear of that. I mean, I was like a little white kid, and you know, middle school happened, and it was like being around, you know, college athletes, and I was not that. And so that was, you know, that. But anyways, the more I've spent time as an adult, I think not everybody looks the same, even amongst a cult. You know, if I'm around people of a different demographic, they don't all look the same anymore. And I'm able to, and that just comes through time, I think, time of being around them, of being around people who look different, and being able to just like, oh, because we all have them. I mean, if we, you know, take someone from any, with any color skin, and we can find someone who's going to make you feel uncomfortable of that color skin because of the way they appear. And then we're going to find others who you're like, I don't think I need to worry about that person. And that's because just as humans, that's what we're used to seeing. And so it just takes time of being around people who are looking different for our brains and bodies to go, oh, I don't have to have this constant threat level, you know, assessing. These all look like the people I imagine being bad people or whatever. So. Yeah. Good.
Good. I want to open up to you all. Burning questions for our panel.
Before I wrap it up.
Yeah. So in y'all's work and in the things y'all volunteer with, I assume y'all are kind of initiating relationships with people that are set up to meet a practical need a lot of the time. How do y'all transition those kind of transactional relationships to relationships that have anything deeper going on? Like, what are some practical ways?
Great question, Chase. Transitioning relationships that could be one way giving into friend relationships. Did I get that right?
Yeah. Exactly. I put a lot of stock in the
curriculum we use. It is one that you can't go through just being a teacher. It invites very much, we're all going through this. We're going to all share our stories of brokenness. It kind of does a good job of structuring some of that, which helps make the time we spend together in a like very classroom time just kind of starts chipping away at the ice, you know, and just weakening it so that it feels more natural and normal to then invite somebody over, you know. And that was a big invited a guy that I've kind of had a relationship with through one of the groups to come watch one of the boxing matches, you know, and it was really fun. It was like, oh, it's like cool. It's like friending. It wasn't like anything. There was nothing going on other than we were just hanging out with some other people and watching a fight. And it was great. So.
Yeah, so I guess just to echo that, the classroom dynamic sets people around a table just like this. And there is this sort of like everyone's a learner in the space. So although someone might be needing to learn to get a job or manage the finances, somebody else's need is to sort of figure out how do I engage in this kind of relationship. So everyone's got a need and they can meet it around the table.
Speaking from outside that curriculum, just in like, so for me as a teacher or if I meet somebody at church, I think one thing I try to do is like, even if I am meeting a physical need, maybe not focusing on the physical need, like I'm like, sure, I'm here to meet this, but like asking questions like I would trying to make a friend anywhere else in a space. Like when you have like meet and greet time at church and you're like, hey, how long have you been going here? And you know, you have like that kind of that awkward like first meet, kind of treating it like that. Like they're just a person. You always can find something in common. I think as a parent, that's like the best in ever is like, you have kids, I have kids. Is like, or you live in Jackson, I live in Jackson, you know, like finding a commonality of like, we live in the same place, or, oh, you like basketball. Oh, you like finding something in common and just starting there, because everyone, you know, everyone has a story and everyone has, you know, just the shared humanity of it. I think just focusing on that instead of focusing on like, hey, I'm here to help. It's like, hey, I'm so glad to meet you. Like, how long have you been here? You know, and having that conversation just like you would in any other space, like meeting a kid's parent or meeting someone at church, and just kind of like thinking about it more on that level instead of like, I have to turn this person into a project and then we've got to be friends because I want to get to know them. Like, don't overthink it. Just be like, I'm meeting them just like I would meet anyone else anywhere else. And just treating them like a friend, like a potential friend, is helpful for me.
Yeah. What thoughts, questions out there?
Are you talking about like in like a mercy ministry situation, like with like people calling up a church and being like, hey, I need help paying rent?
Yes.
And then you're saying, then how do we do? What do we do here?
Yeah,
great. Oh, sorry. Okay, that's a really good question, and Levi knows some things about that because I've talked to you and Kateri about that, and I've not done work with that, but I know you have. I mean, somewhat, but not. I don't. Yeah. You know, that's true. I guess it just feels like friends. I think it needs to be really hard is what I would say. Like it if it's not hard, if it's simple, like we're rolling this out. We got how much money? You got needs. We're going to dole it out. Then we're doing something really wrong. And if we have really big needs that we have to go to another a stranger to get met, then we really need people. Like, and man, people need people.
Yeah. So in that vein, inviting people into a group. Hey, so glad you came and you're looking. You need help in this moment. We have a group of people that I think would be a lot of people journeying and with similar stories and different stories and similar struggles and different. They're in different places, and we'd love for you to be a part of that, because what you need more than your light bill to be paid. You do need that. But that's the tip of the iceberg. So we'd love for you to come and just experience being with us in another setting that's not so much about, you know, just doesn't feel so humiliating or something.
So is that more of a, no, you can't have that, but you can come to this? Or more of a, yes, you can have that, and also come to this?
Yeah, both.
That's the challenge that I think that your diaconate has got to start wrestling with. What is our stance? Are we here to dole out money because we think money is the solution to the problems that we're facing? Or are we here to truly engage developing relationships with people? And if so, right, yeah, while being a part of it, you know, while meeting the need in ways that are reasonable. So that's a hard, like, that's a, I don't got the answer to that one. So, but that's a question to ask.
Great. I know that we're over time, so if you have children, I'm sure you can. But I have one thing to wrap this up so I can guide you in there. But I want to ask, somebody else has got a question out there, right? It's burning. We can do one more question for the panel. Because, again, they're not coming back, so you got to ask now. You can also catch them afterwards. You guys are also polite to it.
I have a question. So kind of going off what you said, Jessica, one of my biggest fears with relational ministry is making someone feel like a project. So how do you kind of get over that fear? And like, that is kind of my focus, is like, I don't want to make you feel like a project. I don't want to make you feel like a project. So how do you get past that?
It's hard.
To all of y'all.
I feel like it's constant work. I think it's not like something that you just is a light bulb and you're like, I acknowledge this in myself and then I change. I think if you think about it from like a Christian perspective and like a sin issue, you don't say, wow, I really struggle with jealousy. I prayed about it. It's over. Like it doesn't happen like that. You know, it's a continual fight. It's a continual learning process. And I think knowing that going in makes it seem like it almost like lets you breathe, you know, like I don't have to have it all together to start. I don't have to have mastered this in order to start a relationship. I think you know that you're going to make mistakes, and I think you know that sin is going to be in your heart no matter what, and you're just going to keep on keeping on and just praying along the way and praying for God to, you know, change your heart and praying, you know, Lord, help me view this person the way you do. And you don't view me as a project. You view me as your daughter, you know. Help me see your daughter in this woman. Help me see this woman that you created or this man that you created that you love and not something that I need to fix or something that I'm trying to like feel better about myself to do. Because that, I mean, I'll admit, like, I was the first to be like, look at the trip I just took. Look at this picture of this cute kid that I just, you know, was at this orphanage with, right? I mean, it's so easy to be like, look, it makes you feel good, right? To do something for other people. And I think it's okay to feel good, to help someone, but where's the motivation? Are you feeling good because you feel like God called you to that and you're just honored to be a part of the work? Or do you feel good because like your Instagram feed looks great, you know? So I think just the constant reminder of how God views that person, and then just know that it's just going to keep being hard, you know, and just keep think about how you view other people. Think about how you view, like, your mom, your, you know, because people are people's moms, people's daughters, people, you know, and just to keep that in a context and not view it as, like, this is a person that I have to, like, check a box with, I guess. I don't know.
I would say just keep the end goal in mind. If the end goal is to get the person to XYZ, right, it's on the project side versus my goal is to get to know you better, to be known by you. It helps with framing.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, the only way I have started growing in not being people to the project is by experiencing being around people and treating them like a project and going, you know, that it's like, you know,
it happens.
It's like getting
yeah.
better at conflict. The only way to get better at conflict is by trying out conflict, you know? So, that's for me.
That echoes the time aspect that you mentioned. That, like, just literally just the process of time and trying it over seasons opens up so many doors.
I do got to let you guys go. So, I want to explain a few things that are on here. And I want to end with this verse from Jesus. And it is a very familiar verse. He sends out the 72. But I found it very instructive for this conversation. So I'm going to read this, and then I'm just going to frame it, explain your homework, and then we'll go. So here's what Jesus says. Luke chapter 10. After, in chapter 9, Jesus had challenged some of the people about the cost of following him. He appointed 72 others and sent them two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he was about to go. He told them, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. Go. I'm sending you out like lambs among wolves. Don't take a purse or a bag or sandals, and don't greet anyone on the road. To me, this is all about place, all about going to these towns, these places, these neighborhoods where he was about to go, where his spirit was already at work, and saying, guess what? If you go there and you prioritize your stuff, your money, that's going to be the focus of the relationship, or they're going to get stolen from you. So don't make it about the money or the things. Go out. And guess what? There's wolves out there. It's dangerous. He didn't promise them it was safe, but he said, and later they'll end up helping people, healing people. They'll do a lot of things with the people as they'll report later as you keep reading this chapter. But I thought it was so instructive, just this reminder that in his calling and his reminder to the disciples not to make it about the things that they carried that made them safe, but about they had the message of life. They knew the author of life, and he was the one that they needed to meet. And continue to keep those straight. So anyway, it was really instructive to me. But you flip that page over, you'll see the work for this week. And a lot of other content, a lot of good stuff I want you to just to be able to have access to. So I number one, there's a part of a chapter from this book called Toxic Charity that I've mentioned. I want you to read that. It's a very powerful and it's a very cutting chapter, the way that this guy talks about what happens when you go to another neighborhood and you start serving. How your presence there, it's helpful perspective from the perspective of a neighbor who's dealing with volunteers in their neighborhood. Great read because it helps you understand how to not be that, but also how to understand the tension. Number two, we talked about a lot about complex issues related to poverty. And there's a sheet, the one of the final parts of that handout is this whole, this is just a great breakdown of like all the complex factors in poverty. Broken relationship or broken bad decisions on the part of the person in poverty is one aspect, but there's three others. And so it's helpful framing. It's good information as we start to make different choice or think about differently. And finally, I shared some what I thought were some common hurdles. I just want you to think through the common hurdles I've found to people engaging in a space that's different from theirs. And so it's just some reflections that I have about that. So anyway, do with this what you will, but it's helpful information that kind of continues this conversation in your own private space. So thank you guys so much. Let me pray for us and we'll get you guys out of here. Heavenly Father, Lord of life, giver of life, sustainer of life, we thank you for this chance to be together tonight. Thank you for this panel and a chance for us to hear each other's stories and experiences. God, I pray that you begin to continue to take these ideas and thoughts and put them into practice, and you would connect us to safe places to process this. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.